Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, Mandy, the movie, not the evergreen Barry Manilow classic. Film director Panos Cosmatos will be discussing his fantasy horror hit a little later in the show.
We'll also be welcoming historian Kathleen Burke back to the show. Her new book looks at the global influence of the US and the UK and why it's a partnership that's been centuries in the making.
And we'll be hearing from Val Garland, leading makeup artist in the fashion industry, whose new book captures some of the chaos behind the catwalk.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here talking us through next week's news. And we'll enjoy some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Hi, Tom.
Good to be here. Rob, have you had a pleasant week? Good weekend so far?
It's been quite a decent week. I've been back. I was away from the office for 3 weeks. Bit of travelling, holiday, and a nice job for you that our listeners will hear later in the year, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Keep that one under wraps.
Keep that one under wraps.
What's the highlight, though? Where of the places you've been on your globetrotting? Anything that stood out particularly?
I climbed up most of an active volcano in Japan, Mount Asama.
Go on.
Yeah. Well, we woke up, my wife and I woke up in a nice hotel room, pulled back the curtains. You know, you arrive in a hotel room in late at night and you don't know what's outside. Beautiful 18-hole championship golf course. About £500 a round. So I was like, there's a volcano in the distance. Let's climb up that instead.
And was it smouldering away even as you woke?
It was puffing away.
Okay.
Last time it kind of got angry is in 2011, I think.
Oh, they're relatively
adjacent. So relatively, though. Yeah. So yeah, it's nice. I got some idea of plate tectonics.
Seismic feel, rumblings.
Seismic rumblings. That's got nothing to do with Fernando Augusto Pacheco, other than it does sound like next week's news. There was something in the air that night. The
stars were bright. Fernando, it's next week's news today. Where should we start?
It is indeed. And usually I have quite a few light stories, but today, you know, a lot of elections happening. So I simply cannot avoid them. And I am a little bit of an election freak.
You are, aren't you? I
do like it. Let's start. Shall we start in Germany? Actually, there are two elections that I'll be talking about. They're happening today. The first one are the state elections in Bavaria, in Germany, of course. And the interesting thing about this election then is everybody's talking about it. For the first time in history, the CSU, which is the sister party of CDU of Angela Merkel, they might have less than 40% of the vote, and they might have to enter in a coalition of other parties, or who knows, they might not even be the majority party. I think they will still be, but you never know what's going to happen. And I think this is breakthrough, and you wonder, so who people are voting for. So I think there's quite a few different trends. The Greens are performing quite well in Bavaria, which is interesting, you know, one of the most conservative states there in Germany. AfD as well, the far right, doing 12-13%. So I think it'd be interesting. And I think the main story here as well, which implications will have to Angela Merkel's government as well. So,
and is this sort of new man of Bavarian politics, is he the governor of Bavaria, whatever the term is? Is he the CSU guy, and he should be natural kind of friends with the CDU, but is kind of playing fairly hardball with the negotiations on what is possible?
Exactly. I mean, they've been having the CSU and the CDU, they've been having some disagreements over immigration policy. Mm. And I wonder if perhaps some of the voters, especially the ones going to AfD, they want even kind of more restrictions, you know, to immigration there as well. And the more left-leaning ones are going to Greens. So, yeah, it will be. I look forward to see the result of this one.
It's an interesting one with Germany. Sorry, Tom.
No, it is interesting. And another thing that's funny is that Angela Merkel, you know, the beginning of the end of the Merkel era has been pronounced for about 15 years.
Yeah.
But this really is it. And it's instructive. It's inevitable that these regional votes will be used as something of a bellwether for her. I don't know, even the succession argument, and that is perhaps not the people out there to take over from Mutti, maybe. If you think about Merkel as the pan-European unity figure, I guess there were a whole load of other countries that were invested in her ongoing success, not just her own sort of demographic. So that's probably also shaped it. And, you know, Europe has changed a lot since. I mean, think of what's been going on, you know, over the last 15 years, just in terms of, like, the road to federalism or whatever, so... Very complicated.
Absolutely. But do you know, still talking about elections, do you know who will be out of power? I mean, I feel scared, you know, predicting results here on the weekly. But Luxembourg also is voting for its general election today. And Prime Minister Xavier Bettel, I think he will be out in a way. I mean, he's been voted in 2013 in a coalition of parties. And the interesting thing about Xavier, I mean, he's gay and his partner has been, you know, going, you know, when they have a meeting of the first ladies, it's very nice that Xavier, because some gay, not all gay leaders have their partners, you know, going in the international scene. But Xavier did that, which I think was quite nice of him. But I think he's leaving power and the main party in Luxembourg that dominated in the last 40 years, with the exception of this last government, is going back to power. It's the party of Jean-Claude Juncker as well. Let's see what's going to happen. Another aspect of the Luxembourg election, there's been a law, I think, being voted last year, which make it easier for you to become a Luxembourg national. And even the resident, if you want to apply for residency there, you don't need to live there for 7 years, but only five. So there's a lot of new voters. Only in this election, 14,000 new voters. And only last year, more than 9,000 people got the nationality as well. So I wonder if this will influence the result as well.
Are we going anywhere else on our news journey?
We're going to Canada Wednesday. We've been talking about the story for so long, but finally, marijuana will become legal in Canada. So from that day on, you can go and buy it in local shops. And it's interesting because, not again, from my perspective, I think only Uruguay have the same as advanced laws when it comes to marijuana as Canada, in a way. And I've been reading, you know, the Latin American press. They didn't have major problems. Let's remember as well, the Uruguay, very small country, fairly peaceful with not huge issues in a way. Because I believe even in Holland, they want to restrict more. There's been a few changes in the laws here and there. Mm. But Canada, I think, would be quite important. And I think people will look at the example of what's happening to Canada before changing their laws in their own countries as well.
Well, it's also very instructive. There's huge changes in terms of the economy, industry, businesses, a huge growth, if you'll forgive the pun, in businesses that are attached or affiliated in some way to this broader legalization process. So it could be a really important moment, and it advances the idea that not just from the taxation, but as a driver of innovation, again, perhaps ironically, if you consider what the substance we're talking about, that sort of, it's another big sort of argument in favour of a programme of legalisation rather than restriction.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, as ever, thank you very much for next week's news. Kathleen Burke is Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London and a familiar voice here on Monocle 24, of course. Her new book, The Lion and the Eagle, looks at how the UK and the US's appetite for empire building over the last 250-odd years has shaped the world. Most disastrously, it should be pointed out.
And she joins us now to tell us more. Kathleen, welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House. You're here with a slightly different hat on, your more writerly hat, as the mind behind your new fairly sort of epic, sweeping history.
That's what you're saying.
it is big. Give us a bit of the origin story, because I imagine some of our listeners are possibly familiar with some of your previous works, which have looked at, again, at sort of Anglo-American relations. Tell us the origin story of this latest edition.
Well, the last large book I did on Anglo-American relations is published, oh dear, about 2007. And it got extremely good reviews. And there was quite a nice one in the TLS by a chap from Harvard. And he was nice. And then he said, one thing she didn't really take account of was the two empires. And I had two reactions. First of all, how long a book did he want to read? Secondly, I was sick of Anglo-American relations. And then, as you probably know, Tom, I went off and wrote a book on wine. But then, you know, the idea of the empires kept niggling at my brain, you know. And I thought, all right, we'll see what there is. And there it is. And hundreds of pages later, everything you might possibly want to know about the two empires. It's not history of empires. It's not even a history of each of those empires. It's the history of how they interacted, especially out on the periphery. If you're out in China, what are they doing together or not doing together? Because, of course, In the Far East, they cooperated. There were other enemies they could... But in Canada, along the border, that's two empires in conflict. A little-known fact. Americans invaded Canada a dozen times in the 19th century. So it's things like that, that where they were in conflict, they were in conflict. And I'm really interested in how they did it and how they didn't actually, after 1812, what the Canadians call their, the Americans call their Second War of Independence, they didn't actually come to blows very much all the time.
I wanted to ask about that, whether two kind of world-spanning empires can ever coexist, you know, whether this is, your book is necessarily the story of the rise of one as the other declines, or is it, it's clearly more nuanced than that, but is that sort of what happened?
Well, there is. I mean, the point is when the Americans got their independence, they carved out their independence from the world's superpower. Britain, after 1815, was the global superpower. There was no question of that. But they didn't care about Europe. Europe could get on and fight each other and so forth. But they went out and built on the controls of the ocean and the fact that an awful lot of Scots, as well as English, quite liked going out and taking over other countries. I mean... How do I say this nicely? Not a lot to do in Scotland if you weren't a crofter or, you know, perhaps an Edinburgh lawyer.
Catherine, tell us a little bit about some of the methodology, if you like, because as you sort of alluded to already, aspects of this have been documented before, of course, but the particular sweep that you take is quite particular. Presumably you had spent many hours, and I know there's some acknowledgements in the book about people who helped you, whether it's going through microfiche and all the rest of it. Some kind of old-fashioned scholarly endeavour was involved in this. Presumably something that's, I don't know, is it still as appealing as ever it was for you, or sometimes you wish there were a few shortcuts?
Well, I like getting my hands dirty. I mean, the helper you're alluding to is one of my many, many sisters, who lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, and in her spare time would occasionally find things on the net for me because she's much better than I am. And a day or two actually went, in fact, to the National Archives and read microfilm. But I did that for days, weeks, months. And in the 19th century and earlier, of course, things aren't printed. You know, you can't photocopy. You have to read things that's written in handwriting, as I think I may say, as bad as mine. you follow an idea. You after you've done it as many times as I have, you get a sense. You get a sense of what is interesting to follow up, what is likely to be productive. And occasionally, you just find a file so interesting, you keep reading it, because it's a human story, and you want to know what's going to happen at the end of it. But you have to be pretty focused. You can't have long lunch hours. You have to get there when it opens, not wander in at 12. Do you see what I mean? It's a very disciplined sort of thing. But you know, there's nothing else I would rather do. Unless perhaps be a wine merchant.
Well, do another book about wine.
Well, is that a possibility.
You start with trying to come to a definition on what an empire is, Kathleen. And I wondered how the British and American empires of the American is one differ. I wonder whether it was simply the matter of, in the British Empire, people being ruled literally by a monarch, whereas in America, it's never defined itself as an empire somehow.
Well, there's a lot of conflict on that, in fact.
Yeah.
The Odd Review has been scathing about my referring to. The point is...
We're referring to America as an empire.
As an empire. Yeah. I mean, the point is that an empire can develop in different ways. It can be conquest... You can marry. Austro-Hungarian Empire grew because of the great dynastic marriages. But the Americans, they see that their extension across the country was really just, you know, Americans extending and so forth and so on. But if you have treaties with Indians and then you go and you shove them out, you wipe them out, if you have, in the 1848, a Mexican-American war, and you get California, Arizona, New Mexico, and so forth. That is conquering an empire, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, if Russia's an empire and they went across to the east, you know, conquering nomad tribe after nomad tribe, if that's an empire, the Americans are an empire. And only at the end of the 19th century did they then go abroad and develop an empire. And that's the Philippines to start with, of course.
So there's a sense that it being the same landmass, it makes it easy to confuse the vanquishing of other peoples with simply stretching your arms a bit.
Well, the American empire is, it's a settler empire, yeah. Just like, you know, Canada and Australia and New Zealand. You had white settlers there getting rid of native, whether they're Maoris or Aborigines or First Nation. But it was people who felt that they had a right to develop because they had law, they organized farming, so they wouldn't waste the land. And so the United States extended an empire. They are a shining city upon the hill. It's land of the free, home of the brave. Well, yes and no. And it just seems to me that that just because an adhesion to truth is not necessarily comfortable.
Do you think the American sense of it is different because America is still living in its present, Britain is living in its past as an empire? So you feel that what you're doing is right because you're living your now, whereas Britain is living its past all the time?
Yes. I mean, the point is that Great Britain was the empire, certainly till the end of the 19th century and still continuing into the 20th. And the Americans weren't really a world power till after the First World War. All this stuff about the rise to world power from 1870 on is just wrong, I think. That's looking backward. That's not how it looked like then. The point is now, of course, the Americans are now in conflict with another growing global empire. And, of course, it's not the United Kingdom, but it's China. So the Americans are already an empire. China is now rising. Are we going to see, 2 centuries after the first one, an interesting sort of clash? Because Britain was the major financial power during that time. The pound was as good as gold. Financial system, you know, was didn't precisely rule the world. All the sorts of things the Americans have now, you know, and no empire thinks it's going to end. The Americans don't think it's going to end. Well, guess what?
Can I ask you about that point, Kathy? Because it's interesting, if you look at the current incumbent in the White House, for example, a man who, as far as I'll make a wild guess, has probably only ever read books about himself, one imagines, would he be amongst those many frontline politicians who seem to display a worrying lack of understanding of the nuance of history or just knowledge of it, who'd be well served in reading a book like this, particularly if it might then inform their decision making, viz., you know, the relationship with China or how to do diplomacy that has an enduring benefit for the people whom you represent? Maybe a little too much to hope, but there is a trend, isn't there? Seems to be a trend of a lack of historical perspective from many of the frontline politicians, which is a bit alarming.
It's not just the frontline politicians. The problem with the American State Department is that, well, not the, you know, the drones at the bottom, who would be such as me, for example, but all those who are political appointees, there's no institutional history. So when you have Nixon and Kissinger thinking what really is difficulty in the Middle East is communism and the extension by the Soviet Union, that is just so terminally stupid, it's hard to believe that Kissinger really believed this. And that does worry me, I must say. Interestingly, when my last one, Old World, New World, was published, because I said Burke does war well and so forth, one of the reviewers in the Times said that this book should be on the desk of in 10 Downing Street and the Foreign Office. But it does show how America spent a century and a half trying to destroy the British Empire. And then when it was destroyed, all of a sudden, they wished it were there. So the book ends with the withdrawal of the British from east of Suez, Singapore and Aden and so forth. And the Americans were incandescent with rage because there they are stuck out in Vietnam all by themselves. They no longer have British territory. One of the 1957, the head of the first head of the CIA's covert operations told a British Foreign Office official, who happened to be Kim Philby, in fact, that whenever we want to destabilize a country, Britain has an island nearby. Well, they lost access to all these islands, except Diego Garcia. So, yes, the Americans didn't like the British Empire until it wasn't there anymore.
Thank you very much for talking us through the lion and the eagle. Congratulations on it as well. Thank you very much.
Many thanks.
Thank you, Kathleen. And Kathleen Burke's new book, The Lion and the Eagle, The Interactions of the British and American Empires, 1783 to 1972, is out now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Rob, I think it's music time.
Me too.
Steel yourself for this one. Something of a departure, but all will make sense. We're going to be hearing from the film director Panos Cosmatos about his new film Mandy in just a moment, the soundtrack of which is informed by the director's lifelong love of metal, Rob. So here's a classic of the genre. We're going to break the Sabbath out. Black Sabbath, Never Say Die.
Never Say Die there by the mighty Black Sabbath. And stay with us for more music and film informed by the dark arts with Panos Cosmatos in just a minute. Mandy is the new horror film by the Italian-Canadian director Panos Cosmatos. Nicolas Cage stars as Red, a chainsaw-wielding lumberjack, hell-bent on revenge alongside girlfriend Mandy, played by Andrea Riseborough, against a cult leader in 1980s California.
The film's been praised for its wild visuals and over-the-top tone, plus a soundtrack that plumbs the menacing depths found in experimental metal and drone music created by recently deceased composer Johan Johansson. Earlier, Monocle's Augustin Macellari caught up with Panos to discuss the film. But first, a clip.
So what are you going to do with that thing?
I'm going hunting.
So what are you hunting?
It's crazy evil.
You think you're so in love? I'll show you love.
Oh man, they wronged you. You exude the cosmic darkness.
It glowed from within, strange and eternal.
I did eventually write more complex backstories for the actors just so they could have them if they wanted them. But as presented in the film, I wanted to keep it a little bit vague and mythical so that the audience can kind of project themselves and their own experiences onto it and maybe even see themselves in the characters, hopefully. So I tried to sort of draw them in very brusque in strokes that would just kind of illustrate them pretty rapidly and hopefully allow the audience to connect with them.
A large sort of part of it is this kind of really unique, as I say, sort of visual language, which draws upon sort of fantasy art and metal. The logo for the film is in this kind of death metal writing. What role did metal have for you growing up? Was that something that you were kind of always locked into?
Yeah, I mean, the first music I ever heard was ABBA, and I immediately loved it. That was when I was quite young, and we were actually living here in London. Many years later, we lived in Mexico. I bought a Kiss cassette. The first tape I ever asked to buy was a Kiss cassette. But while we were listening to it with my mom, the power went out and it actually terrified me. And so for a few years after that, I never listened to metal again because I thought it was demonic or something. And it just, as a child, terrified me. And then a few more years passed and there was a guy in my elementary school who was a year older than me. And I just thought he was the coolest guy and kind of followed him around. And he always had his headphones on. And he ended up loaning me the Motley Crue Shout at the Devil tape. And that was the beginning for me of just being kind of obsessed with metal throughout my entire youth.
It's really funny that, the idea that music can be frightening. I remember really vividly being, terrified by Marilyn Manson and not even wanting to listen to it. Just this guy is so freaky. What am I going to do?
Yeah, at the time, Kiss seemed like this incredibly menacing kind of godlike figures or something, you know?
But then you kind of go from that, which as soon as one starts to sort of pay attention to black metal, you know, there's that amazing film Until the Light Takes Us, which is that documentary. And the narrative of that is one of really genuine menace as opposed to this kind of carnivalesque of kitsch of Kiss.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting how metal has sort of evolved over the years, but I think one of the things that appealed to me was that there was a sort of fantastical element to it, and I always found a kind of escape in it that really kind of meant a lot to me growing up.
I first became aware of Mandy because Stephen O'Malley from Sun tweeted a link to the trailer saying that I played on the soundtrack for this. I went to see the press viewing, and one of the things that struck me was how loud it was.
Yeah,
it was amazing. It's this kind of really intense piece by Johan Johansson, who sadly passed away recently. When you were working with him, can you talk a bit about how that kind of commission came together for him and what you were sending him to give him a sense of what you wanted?
I mean, I never expected that he would work with me, but it turned out that he'd actually seen Beyond the Black Rainbow and wanted to possibly be involved in the next thing that I did. So I talked to him and I realized pretty quickly that he was actually growing up was an Icelandic metalhead. So we had a lot of touchstones in common. And over the course of sort of iterating and writing the film and sort of piecing together visual stuff, I usually make like a playlist that at some points will get like hundreds of songs long, and then I'll eventually, you know, whittle it down to like another 10 songs. So I just gave him that, and he seemed to respond to that and understood the sort of references that I wanted to sort of explore. Neither of us were interested in doing pastiche. We both wanted to sort of interpret these things from our personal perspective and from the present, instead of, you know, just trying to replicate the way stuff sounded back then. But there was a bunch of different stuff on it. You know, there was Black Sabbath instrumental, a couple songs from the Flash Gordon Queen soundtrack, and a Van Halen instrumental track called Sunday Afternoon in the Park, which we were both kind of fixated on this that particular synth sound. So some of it was a very fetishistic thing where we were sort of like talking about different production techniques and synth sounds and stuff like that. And then other times it would just be very vague, strange conversations where you would say to me, like, how do you want this scene to feel? And I'd say, you know, I want it to feel like you're 13 again and you're in the back seat of your older brother's Trans Am and he's smoking weed and you can feel the black leather under you and you can smell the weird vanilla air freshener tree. And he just paused for a second and said, I know exactly what you mean. So I knew at that point that we were meant to work together. I really feel like we only kind of started to scratch the surface of what we could have done. I really wish that we could do another one.
That description you just gave me, the sort of nostalgia of it, it's not a retro film insofar as it's very contemporary, but is set in 1983 and has this kind of sort of encapsulates the sort of death of this hippie ideal. The antagonist has this absolutely ludicrous folk album that he's made. How do you engage with the past in that sense without being nostalgic?
There's good and bad about the past. With these two films, I really wanted to reconnect in a way with the stuff that meant to me a lot as a kid and try to create this intangible thing. The original thought was this idea of an imaginary film, these films that I would imagine when I was not allowed to watch horror films. And I would go into the video store and look at the cover art and read the descriptions on the back and imagine a film that doesn't exist based on that. And that became really kind of seductive to me, this idea of a film that doesn't exist, you know. And I also started to think about, you know, I read an interview with Kurt Cobain a long time ago where he said that growing up in that small town, he only had access to metal music, but he had read about punk rock. So he would listen to metal and read about punk rock and imagine what he thought punk rock sounded like. And that kind of created this third thing that never existed before. And I always thought that was very interesting, this idea of what you imagine something is as opposed to what it actually is or considered a proper way for it to be. It's like a freedom of imagination from what things are supposed to be.
Drugs are a really big part of this film, and also of your last film, particularly sort of psychedelics. I haven't seen anything that takes in the psychedelic or hallucinatory experience like this since Enter the Void, which is the only film that really kind of goes all out in trying to replicate the visuals. Can you talk a bit about what it is about hallucinogenics that you find worthy of interrogating, and is it off the back of kind of similar formative early experiences?
Well, yeah, in high school, I discovered weed and mushrooms and LSD and ended up doing a lot of them. You know, most of it was just, there was nothing to it, but there was a few experiences that were really kind of formative experiences that made me look at the world in a different way and made me realize that you could look at the world in a very different way. At the same time, I'm highly suspicious, to kind of go back to what you were saying about the 60s, of these things being harnessed as a sort of spiritual cure-all and by people who feel like they have all the answers, who I'm always very, very skeptical of and very suspicious of people who seem to think that the way they view the world is the proper way to view the world. And so I've always had a little bit of an adverse relationship with the whole idea of the 60s dominating the idea of what spirituality could and should be. And by the same token, you know, like organized and fundamentalist religion. So I kind of wanted to... I dealt with the more sort of baby boomer new age aspect of that in Black Rainbow, but I wanted to tackle both this fundamentalist Christian religion and the way that has also intersected with the hippies and stuff like that in one fell swoop. So, yeah, you know, I'm not sure if that answers your question.
No, I think it does. I mean, very effectively, it kind of shows this like really seedy underbelly to the hippie messiah icon.
There was a line on that show 30 Rock where somebody said, never follow a hippie to a second location. And I found that to be very, very true.
I hope not through experience. I think a lot of people are going to be aware of this film because of Nick Cage's really fated performance. You know, he pulls out all the stops. And I don't want to dwell on that too much because while it really is an amazing kind of central theme, it's not the reason to see the film. In the casting process, is Nick Cage who you kind of had at the front of your mind?
I had him in mind to play the villain. Growing up watching his work, I wanted to see him play a very outlandish villain like this. But when I met with him, I'd been sort of told that he was interested in playing the villain. And when I met him, the first thing he said was, I want to play Red Miller. And I was taken aback by that and disappointed. And I ended up walking away and thinking, you know, this just is not going to work out. But months later, I had a very vivid dream where I was watching the movie Mandy completed and he was playing Red Miller. And there was just something undeniably compelling about it. And after I was able to get over my fixation with him playing the villain via that dream, I saw that there was a lot of potential there to make this Red Miller character something very dynamic.
I feel like you've kind of already answered this in a sense, given that you sort of work with intuition and a lot of your process is about this imagined reality catalyzed by certain prompts. But I'm interested in how, as an homage to different cultural reference points that have been important to you, you kind of tie up these ends into a coherent narrative. Like, what's the process of that? How do you build a story out of that?
I don't honestly know, you know. I think it's because I have a core story to begin with, which is something very, very simple. For both these films, I wanted to have the storyline itself be very clean and simple and not convoluted or dependent on twists or things like that. So to me, I feel like you could make a very interesting, compelling movie about a guy walking 3 blocks to the store or something if you really wanted to. So for me, story is something that is just a sort of a vehicle around which to build these things in a kind of sculptural way.
Finally, you know, this film exists in a kind of very interesting space where it's simultaneously like a really great action horror, and it's also a very thoughtful art house film, for want of a better word. And you know, this is something that I first thought of watching David Cronenberg's films, which occupy a similar space, Videodrome. Neither a horror, nor is it. It's not a blockbuster, but it kind of has the visual language of one. Right. Is this where you want to stay? Or would you like to kind of make something with a broader, more orthodox set of ways in for audiences?
Right. I feel this might be my version of that. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll have to see, you know. I'm not sure yet.
Things can only get weirder.
Panos Cosmatos there, discussing Mandy with Augustin Macellari. Do head to your local cinema to check it out. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Val Garland is one of the fashion industry's leading makeup artists, working on shoots and shows with everyone from Vivienne Westwood to Kate Moss and Lady Gaga.
Her new book, Validated, looks back on her journey in the business, starting as a self-taught creative influenced by punk and the New Romantics to becoming an integral part of catwalk shows across the fashion industry calendar and contributing beauty editor at British Vogue.
Monocle's fashion editor, Jamie Waters, met Val earlier to learn a little bit more.
I never planned to be a makeup artist. My sister was a hairdresser and I thought, oh yeah, okay, well, I'll just do that till I do what I really want to do, which is bizarre, because in like 1972, I wanted to work with computers. And in all the magazines, there were these various sort of like little ads that would sort of say like computer programmers wanted. And I was like, oh yeah, that's the future. You know, it's science. It's amazing. I want to do that. But I thought, well, in the meantime, I've just walked out of school. And I just ran out of school and thought, shit, I don't have a job. And so I just thought, oh, no, it'd be very easy to be a hairdresser. So I just went, you know, got myself an apprenticeship. And then that sort of took me to Australia. I met a guy, he was a drummer in a band, a Bristol band, and, you know, we got married and he sort of said, oh, let's go somewhere else. I thought he was going to say, let's go to Paris or let's go to New York. And he said, let's go to Australia. And I was so kind of like wanting to be really cool in 1976. And I sort of said, yeah, okay, yeah, great. Yeah, let's go to Australia. And so I remember coming to London to the Australian High Commission and they sort of said, so you're a hairdresser. Where would you like to, where are you planning on being in Australia? And I said, well, I want to be somewhere really hot. And they sort of said, well, Perth is quite hot. And I'm like, okay, yeah, let's go to Perth. And so that's how I found myself in Perth, Western Australia.
Oh.
But interestingly enough, and I was a hairdresser there, but Perth was a very cool scene in the 80s. You know, there was lots of great bands there. It was a very, yeah, it was, I think probably because it was so far away, it was trying so hard to be trendy. And trendy is such an old-fashioned word. But anyway,
I grew up there in the 90s, so right. I know it well. But yeah, there's always been kind of cool music scene.
Music scene. I thought the music scene was, yeah, it was amazing. And so with in those days in the 80s, with the music scene came the fashion scene. And in the 80s, we were in the period of New Romantics. So, you know, boys were girls and girls were boys and everybody was bisexual. And, you know, everybody wore makeup and had funny haircuts and funny colours. And it all seemed quite ordinary to us to look like absolute, you know, works of art. And I think that's when I was a hairdresser and I had my own salon. And I think because I started wearing makeup on myself and loads of it, you know, and I was very heavily influenced by a makeup artist who was doing makeup for a magazine that was big in London called the Blitz magazine, or Blitz. And his name was Yali Back. And I thought he was a girl, actually. I didn't realise he was a boy. But he used to do this really creative makeup that was probably quite punk or New Romantic. And he used to paint sort of like pictures on the face and like the makeup had shifted. And it was all very experimental. And I was like, well, that's what's happening in London. So I'm going to be like that here in Perth. So anyway.
But you were self-trained.
Self-trained. Yeah. Then I moved to Sydney and I opened a salon there. And everybody used to come to my salon. Like the photographers would come, the fashion directors, the models, they all came to my salon to have their hair done. And at that time, you know, I was working with the likes of Kylie Minogue, This Is How Old I Am, and In Excess. And I think that was my eureka moment when I used to cut In Excess's hair. And because I was a salon hairdresser and sort of part-time makeup artist, I wasn't considered cool in the session world because I came from a salon. And anyway, so In Excess were making a video and a music clip, and I cut all the boys' hair anyway. They had like a makeup artist stroke groomer doing them for this video. And then the stylist rings me up at 10 o'clock at night on a Saturday night and sort of says, we need you to come to the studio now because Michael doesn't want anybody else touching his face apart from you. And I could hear Michael Hutchence in the background going, get me Garland now. And I was like, oh my God, I've made it. Like, you know, so yeah, I guess.
Surreal kind of.
Yeah, so that was kind of a eureka moment. And then I started sort of doing what we call tests with various photographers and models. And I'd do it for the agencies for like the models' portfolios and stuff. And I was still doing hair. And people kept saying, oh, you should do the makeup. And I was like, oh, I don't know about that fashion world. You know, they're all a bit tricksy and everything's so fabulous and everyone's so nasty. And I thought, no, I don't want to get into session work. But my friends that were photographers kept sort of saying, no, you should do it. And then one day the makeup artist didn't turn up on this shoot and the photographer said, right, Val, you've got to do the makeup. And of course, in my bag, this was the 80s, so most of my makeup was white, red, black, lots of primary colours. So I did the makeup for the model. And of course, I just did the makeup that I knew. So I made her look like me. So she had these sort of like great big black, sort of like coal-like eyes and a sort of a wonky red lip. And, you know, by and by, you know, people would start booking me for makeup. So it just kind of like gradually happened. And then when I came to London, I still didn't know whether I was going to be doing hair or makeup. But at that time in the early 90s, if you could do both, and I believe you can do both and you can do both very well, but you weren't cool or you weren't considered a true professional unless you specialised. But that has changed now. Hopefully by now, 30 years later, I may have got it right. I'm not quite sure yet though.
I wanted to talk about some of the kind of shifts in different types of makeup that are popular. I mean, you've already referenced like the 80s when some of the really bold makeup and the new romantics, yeah. And then it became really sort of fresh-faced in the 90s. Yeah. And then we've had, I mean, there's, you know, with the whole maximalist movement in fashion more recently, there's been some bolder makeup as well. But how do these shifts or trends in makeup come about? And I'm wondering do they follow trends in fashion? What's the kind of relationship between fashion and makeup?
Well, I think if I look at the 80s and the time before, the 70s, the 60s, the 50s, I think most of our influences come from music. Fashion was led by music. I think fashion is still led to a certain degree by the celebrities within music, but I think now fashion and beauty is much more driven by social media. Well, number one, you've got to be a celebrity. And if you're a celebrity, then you can sell anything. So, or you can make anybody wear anything. I mean, who would have thought that one day Crocs would have been fashionable, but yet they were. And
devastating.
Devastating. I think, especially through, social media, there has been much more of a maximalising of makeup as well as fashion. You know, as consumers, we are more is more is more is more. And I think that there are many types of makeup artists. And there are so many people who, like myself, are self-taught, have taught themselves in their bedrooms to do makeup. And then, lo and behold, they're on YouTube and suddenly they've got, like, you know, 4 million followers. And they are a makeup artist or they are an artist of their own face. But I think to be truly a true makeup artist, a true professional makeup artist, you need to know how to do makeup on other people. It's quite different doing makeup on yourself in a mirror than it is doing makeup on another person. Because fundamentally, think about this situation. You're going to meet, it could be anybody. It could be, you know, the lady from the grocery store down the road. It could be a Kardashian. It could be a high-profile celebrity. But somehow or another, you are meeting a stranger for the first time and you are going to go right up to their face, get in their face and touch them. You know, that's quite scary for them. And it's also a little bit scary for you. So you better know what you're doing. And I think, for me, people sort of say to me, like, how do you choose makeup artists to be on your team? And I always say, first and foremost, I have to know, can they do skin? If they can do skin, then, you know, we can come to the rest of it. I can teach them the rest of it because the rest of it is just sort of like, it's technical and it's paint.
What do you mean? Can they do skin?
when, can they do a natural makeup? Okay. You know, is can you do a natural makeup? Can you make any woman feel more confident, look more beautiful, feel more empowered through makeup?
I'm wondering if there are kind of any standout looks for you. I mean, it's a big question, but you know, if there were particular looks or shoots that you worked on when you that were kind of most that really kind of stick out over the course of your career.
Well, there's many. You know, I mean, one that comes to mind is I remember working with Nicola Formichetti, Sam McKnight, and we were doing Lady Gaga, and we'd already started working with her, and Nicola said, we've got this shoot coming up with Nick Knight and we want to do something different with her that, you know, we've not seen before. And at this moment in time, Gaga had quite a strong brow. She was wearing lots of fake eyelashes. And, yeah, she had quite a sort of, you know, she had a strong beauty look. And Nicola sort of said, so what do you want to do? What could we do that's different? And so I thought about it. We were in Milan at the time, and we only had an hour with Gaga because Sam and I were between shows and Gaga was jetting off on a private jet somewhere else. And I said, oh, I don't know. I think let's get rid of her eyebrows. Let's, like, bleach her eyebrows. Then let's take off the false eyelashes. Let's give her, like, a strong, punky, punchy eyeliner. Make it very, very graphic. No mascara. And then maybe we might do some prosthetics. And they'd be like, kind of like, okay. And I said, yeah, let's do prosthetics. And they were like, what's prosthetics? I said, oh, let's, through special effects, change the shape of her face. Why don't we sort of give her kind of like pointed cheekbones? And I literally got these two little bits of paper, made them into sort of like paper aeroplanes, and just sort of like stuck them on her skin here. And I said, well, it would kind of look something like this. And Nicola took a picture. And that's all that's the last I heard of it. Anyway, 3 months later, where I turn up for work with Nick Knight out at Park Royal Studios and walk in, and there's a prosthetic specialist there, and he sort of said, oh, I've made your prosthetics for you, Miss Garland, you know, the ones that you designed for Gaga. And I'm like, oh, what, you mean like the little paper aeroplanes that I just stuck on her cheek in paper? So, you know, that's how it all came about. So, you know, I didn't actually apply the prosthetics. We had the proper person there to do it. And it was amazing, but I kind of like made a rod for my own back, because it meant for that whole kind of like year of that album, every time, you know, I was with her, we'd have to have like an hour of prosthetics before I did the makeup. But it was great, you know.
And I mean, it's an interesting process. Like, how does that sort of collaborative process work? I mean, I'm assuming it's very different, you know, depending on who the different people are, but what's the kind of general dynamic between yourself, you know, designer, photographer? Like, how does the team work? Will someone give you quite a tight brief? Is there a lot of interaction between you and the other kind of members of the creative team?
I guess as an artist, a makeup artist, it's all about teamwork. But, you know, it can either be, you know, a talk a month before with lots of preparation between you, the designer, the stylist, the fashion director, and maybe the hairdresser, or else it's the night before. I mean, like, sometimes if I'm doing, like, say it's the Vivienne Westwood show, you know, I will meet with her and Andreas and Sam, Marion, the night before the show, and we'll talk through what the look's going to be, and then I'm probably doing it at 7 o'clock the next day, you know, showing my team what we're going to do and just getting on with it. And, you know, sometimes you can be completely prepared and sometimes you've got to make it up as you go along. There was this one time that I worked with Vivienne, and I've worked with Vivienne Westwood for many, many years, and usually I will go to the studio. And I'm always expecting the unexpected because I never quite know what's going to be going on. Anyway, this particular day I walked in and I went up to Vivienne and I sort of said, OK, so hi, Vivienne. So what's our muse this season? Like, you know, like, what are we doing? Like, who's our woman? And she just looked at me and she said, horses. And I said, okay. And she'd gone. She'd walked away. So she only said one word, horses. So then I went back to my team and Sam's there and I said, Sam, what did she say to you? And he had this whole sort of spiel about, you know, what the hair was going to be like. You know, they were travellers. It was like a festival. And I said, well, she just said horses. I don't know what she means. And so then I got the lovely Joey. I said, right, let's have a look on Google. Let's look at horses. Let's make a story. We've got to make a story out of this. So we started looking at the pelts of the animal. And I said, okay, this is going to be our story. We're going to be working in black and white. And we're just going to do like the markings that you'll see on zebras or horses. And that's what we did for the show. But, you know, sometimes...
Was she happy with it?
She was totally happy with it. And later on, I think it was like 2 or 3 years later, she said to me, do you know what, Val? She said, I have to say, the horses show is one of my favourite makeups you've ever done. And I'm like, you.
I love that she just sort of announced and then that was it. Like,
oh,
disappeared.
No, totally.
No more instructions needed.
Yeah, yeah.
Val Garland there speaking to Jamie Waters. And Val's book, Validated, The Makeup of Val Garland, is out now. And you are with The Monocle Weekly. And that is it, Tom. 484 editions of The Monocle Weekly under the Monocle Weekly belt. I've thoroughly enjoyed today's show.
It's been good.
Sitting in a studio with you once again.
Absolutely.
That's the first time in weeks. So thank you to all our guests, and let's thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall, and our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and George Madonna. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.